Welcome back to the lab, to the children of Israel, the people of the book, and my own flesh and blood. I write this file as a son of the tribe. I am Ashkenazi, born of the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. While I was not raised in a strictly observant household, the rhythm of our people, the logic of the Talmud, and the melody of the Kol Nidre is in my DNA. I love the Torah. It is the ethical bedrock of Western civilization. But as a researcher, I have to look at our systems honestly. And when I look at modern Judaism, I see a disconnect. We are a people who cherish the Torah, yet we are following a system that looks nothing like the one Moses gave us. The engine has been swapped out, and most of us never asked when or why. I'm not asking you to leave your Jewish identity. I am asking you to reclaim the full picture of it. Quote, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. End quote. Ezekiel 36:26, Section 1.0, The Logical Dilemma, The Broken Altar. To understand the crisis, we have to look at the contract of the Torah. The law of Moses was not just a philosophy, it was a legal agreement with specific mechanisms. The central equation, Leviticus 17:11, the Torah is explicit about how human error or sin is processed. Quote, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. The constraint, Deuteronomy 12:13-14. Crucially, God added a restriction. You could not just offer a sacrifice in your backyard. It had to be done only at the place the Lord will choose. That meant the temple in Jerusalem. The logic, you need blood to fix the sin. You need the temple to offer the blood. 1.1, the catastrophe, 70 AD. In 70 AD, the Roman general Titus breached Jerusalem. Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, records in the Jewish War, Book 6, Chapter 2, the exact moment the Tamid, the daily sacrifice, ceased. He notes that on the 17th of Tammuz, the priests ran out of lambs, and for the first time in centuries, the smoke on the altar stopped. Days later, the temple was burned to the ground. The implication, this wasn't just a tragedy, it was a theological catastrophe. The mechanism required to fulfill the law was destroyed. Legally, this left the Jewish people in a state of breach of contract. The Torah demands a sacrifice, but history has made that sacrifice impossible. 1.2, the transition window, 30 AD to 70 AD. This leads to a critical question. Would God allow his only authorized interface, the temple, to be destroyed without establishing a replacement first? In Jewish theology, there is a principle called Makdim Refua Lamaka. God always prepares the cure before he allows the wound. If the temple was the wound, where was the cure? The historical data shows a precise 40-year transition window. 30 AD, Jesus of Nazareth establishes a new covenant at his Last Supper, claiming his blood is the new atonement. 70 AD, the Romans destroy the physical temple, ending the old atonement system forever. The pre-announcement. Centuries before this happened, the Hebrew scriptures explicitly stated that the old system, the Mosaic covenant, was not permanent. It had an expiration date. God promised that a new system was coming to replace it. Quote, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt. End quote. Jeremiah 31:31-32. The verification data, the upgrade. Jeremiah didn't just predict a different covenant, he predicted a superior one. He detailed exactly how the features would change. Internal change. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. The old system was external stone tablets. The new system is internal transformation of the heart. Permanent forgiveness. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. The old system required yearly reminders of sin on Yom Kippur. The new system promises total erasure. The logical conclusion, therefore, the destruction of the temple in 70 AD was the physical confirmation that the old system had been archived because the upgrade, predicted by Jeremiah and inaugurated by the Messiah, was now active. The inability to fulfill the Torah today is not a failure of God, it is the evidence that he kept his promise. Section 2.0, The Pivot, The Council of Jamnia. Today, if you ask a rabbi how we are forgiven without a temple, they will tell you that prayer, repentance, and charity have replaced the sacrifice. In Hebrew, that is tefillah, teshuvah, and tzedakah. But we must ask, when did that rule change? It is not in the Torah. 2.1. The Crisis Management, Yavneh. After the temple fell in 70 AD, the Jewish faith faced extinction. Without the altar, the central mechanism of the religion was gone. A famous leader, Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai, established a new center for Jewish life in the city of Yavneh, or Jamnia. It was there that the new rules were decided. We actually have the historical record of the moment this shift happened. It is recorded in Avot de Rabbi Natan, 4:5. Quote, "Once, as Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai was coming forth from Jerusalem, Rabbi Joshua followed after him and beheld the temple in ruins. Woe unto us, Rabbi Joshua cried, that this, the place where the iniquities of Israel were atoned for, is laid waste. My son, Rabban Yohanan said to him, be not grieved, we have another atonement as effective as this. And what is it? It is acts of loving kindness, as it is said, for I desire mercy and not sacrifice." End quote. 2.2. The Authority Problem. This is the turning point of history. In that moment, a human leader declared that good deeds were now equal to the blood atonement commanded by God. The logical conflict. While Rabbi Yohanan's intention was to save the people from despair, he did not have the authority to rewrite the contract. God said, "The life is in the blood. I have given it to you to make atonement." Leviticus 17:11. The rabbis said, "We have another way." This shifted Judaism from being a biblical faith based on what God said to a rabbinic faith based on what the sages interpreted. We traded the objective requirement of the Torah for the subjective hope that our good deeds would be enough. But nowhere in the Torah does God say that charity can pay the debt of sin. Only life pays for life. Section 3.0, The Math Problem, The Daniel Timeline. Most people think the Messiah could arrive at any random moment in history. But if we look at the Hebrew prophets, that is not true. The Messiah had a specific arrival time. The prophet Daniel, writing from Babylon, gave a specific countdown known as the 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel 9. He didn't just give a vague era, he started a stopwatch. 3.1, The Equation, The 69 Weeks. In Daniel 9:25, the angel Gabriel gives Daniel the formula. Quote, "From the time the word goes out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. Let's do the math. The unit. In Hebrew prophecy, a seven, or shibuim, is a period of 7 years. The duration. 7 plus 62 equals 69 sets of 7 years. The total, 69 times 7 equals 483 years. The prophecy states that from the command to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, there would be exactly 483 years until the Messiah appeared. 3.2, The Calculation, To the Day. We know from history in Nehemiah 2 that the command to rebuild the walls was given by the Persian king Artaxerxes Longimon on March 14, 445 BC. However, the biblical prophetic calendar uses a 360-day year, not our 365.25 solar year. 483 years times 360 days equals 173,880 days. If you start at March 14, 445 BC, and count forward exactly 173,880 days, you arrive at April 6, 32 AD. What happened on April 6, 32 AD? This was the 10th of Nisan, the very day the Passover lamb was selected. It was the day Jesus rode a donkey into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. For the first time in his ministry, he allowed the crowds to hail him as king. He fulfilled the timeline to the exact day. The mathematical summary. The prediction. Daniel predicted the Messiah would arrive 483 biblical years after the command to rebuild Jerusalem. The start date. March 14, 445 BC. The duration. 173,880 days. The arrival date. April 6, 32 AD. The accuracy. This is not a vague guess. It is a mathematical lock to the specific era, and arguably the specific week, of Jesus' passion. 3.3. The summary of facts. Rather than interpreting the data, we can simply look at the chronological constraints established by the text and history. Constraint A, the timeline. The prophet Daniel predicted a specific period between the command to rebuild Jerusalem, 445 BC, and the arrival of the Messiah. Counting forward 483 biblical years places the arrival in the early 1st century, roughly 30 to 33 AD. Constraint B, the hard stop. The text explicitly states that the Messiah must arrive and be killed before the destruction of the temple. Quote, after the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Daniel 9:26. Constraint C, the historical event. The city and sanctuary were destroyed by Titus in 70 AD. Constraint D, the rabbinic reaction. The Talmud records a harsh reaction to those who attempt to calculate these specific dates. Quote, blasted be the bones of those who calculate the end. Sanhedrin 97b. The decision. The prophecy of Daniel 9 is not open-ended. It has a built-in expiration date. The text requires the Messiah to appear before the legion fires burn the temple. This leaves a historical binary. Either the window closed in 70 AD without a Messiah, leaving the prophecy unfulfilled, or the Messiah arrived within the window, exactly as predicted, but was not recognized at the time. Section 4.0, The Hostile Witness, The Talmudic Omens. This is the most fascinating piece of data I have found. It doesn't come from the New Testament. It comes from the Babylonian Talmud, the central text of Rabbinic Judaism. The Talmud records that during the 40 years before the destruction of the temple, specific omens or anomalies occurred in the sanctuary. To understand why this matters, you have to understand the baseline protocol. 4.1. The mechanism, the public monitor. On Yom Kippur, the high priest performed the scapegoat ritual. He would take a strip of crimson wool and divide it. Piece A was tied to the horns of the scapegoat, which was sent into the wilderness to carry the sins away. Piece B was tied to the door of the sanctuary. The piece on the door served as the public monitor. It was the national status light, based on Isaiah 1:18. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. The expectation was that at the moment the goat was pushed off the cliff in the desert, signaling the sins were gone, the wool on the temple door would miraculously bleach white. 4.2. The audit. A skeptic might ask, maybe the priests just dipped it in bleach. Maybe it was a chemical trick to control the masses. We have to look at the motive and the chemistry. The chemistry problem. In the ancient world, bleaching wool was a slow process. It involved soaking fabric in lye, sulfur fumes, or leaving it in the intense sun for days. The Talmud describes a phenomenon that happened in real time, at the moment the goat was pushed in the wilderness. There was no known chemical agent in the first century that could instantly turn crimson wool snow white in front of a crowd without destroying the fabric. The motive problem. The smoking gun. This is the strongest logical proof. If the high priests were faking the miracle to keep the people happy, why did they stop faking it for the last 40 years? The priests in the first century, mostly Sadducees, were corrupt politicians. They wanted to maintain order. It would have been in their best interest to keep faking the miracle so the public would believe God was still happy with the temple. By admitting that the thread stayed red for 40 years, they were admitting that they had lost their connection with God. This was a public relations nightmare. Logic dictates, corrupt leaders fake success, not failure. The fact that they recorded their own failure for four decades suggests they were witnessing a phenomenon they could not control and could not fake. 4.3. The History of the Signal. The Talmud in Yoma 39b gives us a performance report of this miracle over three distinct eras. Era 1. The Golden Age, approx 200 BC. This era corresponds to the priesthood of Shimon HaTzadik, or Simon the Just. Simon was a giant of history. He was the high priest and the last survivor of the Great Assembly. The Talmud records that his piety was so great that during his 40-year tenure, the crimson thread turned white every single year. Statistical note, in a random system, like a coin toss, the mathematical odds of getting the same result 40 times in a row are approximately 1 in a trillion. This streak of favor was statistically impossible without supernatural intervention. Era 2. The Fluctuating Age, 200 BC to 30 AD. After Simon died, the spiritual state of the nation declined. The miracle became inconsistent. The Talmud says, sometimes it turned white, and sometimes it remained red. The signal was glitchy. Depending on the merit of the current high priest, Era 3, the hard stop, 30 AD to 70 AD. Then, the pattern changed drastically. The sages record, quote, our rabbis taught, during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the crimson thread did not turn white, end quote. The logical conclusion, this wasn't a fluctuation anymore. It was another statistical impossibility, 40 consecutive years of red. The math, 70 AD, destruction, minus 40 years equals 30 AD. The event, 30 AD is the year Jesus was crucified. According to the Talmud, the moment Jesus died, the old system stopped validating the animal sacrifices. The red thread stayed red because the final scapegoat, the Messiah, had already carried the sins away once and for all. Section 5.0, the identity crisis, the two profiles. Why did our ancestors miss him? In the first century, the Jewish world was under Roman occupation. The people were desperate for a conquering king to crush Rome. They focused entirely on the prophecies of glory and ignored the prophecies of suffering. But if we look at the data honestly, the Hebrew prophets described two completely different profiles. 5.1, the contradictory data. The scriptures present a paradox that has puzzled scholars for centuries. Profile A, the suffering servant. The prophets described a humble figure who arrives quietly and dies for the sins of the nation. Quote, rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey. Zechariah 9:9. Quote, but he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities, and by his wounds we are healed. Isaiah 53:5. Profile B, the conquering king. The prophets also described a warrior who arrives from heaven to defeat Israel's enemies and rule the world. Quote, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. Daniel 7:13-14. 5.2, the rabbinic struggle. The tension between these two profiles is undeniable. How can the Messiah be a dying servant and an eternal king? Later rabbinic tradition realized this contradiction was so sharp that they developed a theory of two messiahs, Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, who suffers and dies in battle, Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David, who rules and reigns. The Talmud explicitly discusses this mourning for the suffering Messiah in Sukkah 52a. Quote, the verse Zechariah 12:12 is interpreted as a eulogy for Mashiach ben Yosef, who is killed. The sages saw the data required a death. They just assumed it had to be a different person. 5.3, the logical solution, the two peaks. There is a simpler solution. It is not two different messiahs. It is one messiah with two arrivals. Imagine standing on a plain and looking at a mountain range. You see two massive peaks that look like they are right next to each other. But if you hiked to the first peak, you would realize there is a massive valley, a long span of time, separating it from the second peak. The Valley of Time. The prophets saw the events, the suffering and the reigning, but they couldn't see the timeline separating them. Arrival 1, 30 AD. Jesus came as the suffering servant to deal with the internal problem, sin. He rode the donkey, Zechariah 9:9, but he also fulfilled the grim prediction of Daniel 9:26. Quote, after the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death and will have nothing. The Hebrew word used here is yikaret, cut off, a technical term often used in the Torah for the death penalty or violent excision. He didn't just die, he was executed to pay the debt. Arrival 2, future, he will return as the conquering king to deal with the external problem, evil and war. He will fulfill Daniel 7 by arriving on the clouds to rule. 5.4, the modern shift. You may be wondering, if the two messiah theory is in the Talmud, why have I never heard it in synagogue? The historical pivot. Following the rise of Christianity and the failed revolt of the false messiah Bar Kokhba in 132 AD, the Jewish leadership made a strategic theological shift. To clearly distinguish Judaism from the growing Christian movement, the concept of a dying messiah, Ben Yosef, was de-emphasized and eventually moved to the fringes of Jewish thought. The modern alternative. Today, mainstream Judaism primarily focuses on the conquering king, Ben David, or interprets the suffering servant passages not as an individual, but as the nation of Israel suffering for the world. In many Reform and conservative circles, the belief in a personal Messiah has been replaced entirely by the concept of a messianic age, a time of peace and human progress achieved through our own efforts. The result? This leaves the modern reader with a choice. We can accept the modern reinterpretation that removes the suffering individual, or we can look back at the original data in Daniel and Isaiah, which describes a specific person who dies before the Second Temple falls. Section 6.0, Conclusion, the Anchor. I understand the hesitation. For a Jewish person to consider Jesus, it often feels like betrayal. It feels like leaving the tribe to join the other team. But if we set aside the emotions and look strictly at the data stack, a clear picture emerges. We have two independent lines of evidence, one from Babylon, Daniel, and one from Jerusalem, the Talmud, that converge on the exact same moment in history, the timeline. The math. The prophet Daniel, 9:25, started a countdown of 483 years from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. History records two major decrees issued by the Persian king Artaxerxes. You can look at the text and decide which one fits the prophecy. Exhibit A. The Ezra Decree, 457 BC. The text. Artaxerxes, King of Kings, to Ezra the priest. You are sent by the king to inquire about Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God. And you, Ezra, in accordance with the wisdom of your God, appoint magistrates and judges to administer justice to all the people of Trans-Euphrates. Ezra 7, 12-26. The case. This decree restored the judicial and religious authority of Jerusalem, restoring the city as a governing capital. The result, counting 483 years from this date, lands at 27 AD, the start of Jesus' ministry and his baptism. Exhibit B, the Nehemiah Decree, 445 BC. The text, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, send me to the city in Judah, where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors, and a letter to Asaph, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, and for the city wall. Nehemiah 2, 5-8. The case. This decree authorized the physical reconstruction of the walls and gates. The result, counting 483, prophetic, years from this date lands at 32 or 33 AD, the triumphal entry and Palm Sunday. The verdict, regardless of which decree you believe fits the text better, the countdown expires in the exact same five-year window. The math lands squarely on the life of Jesus of Nazareth. The hostile witness, the Talmud. Our own sages recorded in the Babylonian Talmud, Yoma 39b, that the Yom Kippur miracle, the crimson thread turning white, stopped working 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The math, 70 AD minus 40 years, lands us in 30 AD. The convergence, whether the specific year was 30, 32, or 33 AD, both our prophecy, Daniel, and our oral tradition, Talmud, agree that the old system expired and the Messiah event occurred in that specific window. The profile, the suffering servant. While we expected a conquering king, the prophets also described a suffering servant. Isaiah 53 predicted he would be pierced for our transgressions and cut off from the land of the living. Daniel 9 predicted the anointed one would be put to death and will have nothing. The data requires a Messiah who dies to pay a debt, not just a king who rules. The promise, the new covenant. The prophet Jeremiah explicitly predicted that the Mosaic covenant, the law on stone, was never meant to be permanent. Quote, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people." Jeremiah 31:31-33. God promised a specific shift, moving the law from external tablets to the human heart and offering permanent forgiveness. The invitation, I don't expect you to accept all of this at once. This is a heavy file, and it challenges centuries of tradition. But I do invite you to audit the data. Don't take my word for it. Open your own Tanakh. Calculate the 483 years in Daniel 9. Open the Talmud and read Yoma 39b for yourself. Read Isaiah 53 without the commentary and ask who it describes. If these claims are false, they will crumble under scrutiny. But if they are true, then the Messiah is not a stranger or a traitor. He is the specific solution our prophets promised, arriving exactly on time. The evidence is on the table. The conclusion is yours to draw. The altar is cold, but the Lamb is alive. This is the Quantum Disciple, signing off.